Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be Julie. Either amuse me or lose me, I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape.
Welcome to another week of Whitley on Wine. And this week we're going to climb into a time capsule, something like 150 years. And joining me by telephone from Northern California is Jeff Bunshu, the president of Gunlach Bunshu Winery. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Robert. Happy to be here.
I'm glad that you could make it. You guys have always been one of my favorites, especially from Sonoma County, and I was intrigued that you have your 150th anniversary coming up, and I kind of was kidding in the blog that I did on Wine Review Online today that I was going to grill you on all 150 years. But I looked at your picture, and you don't have enough gray hair.
No, you know, not yet. Maybe after this year I might.
So it's amazing to think that that one family's roots go back that far. Now, I know that the Gunlach side of the family was the original, you know, force behind the winery in 1858, but it wasn't very long before Gunlach's daughter married a Bunshu, and then your family became involved. You're what, the sixth generation?
That's right, the sixth generation since those days.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the play that you've put together that sort of synopsizes the history of Gunlach Bunshu and the family tradition and all that. But before we get into that, and I think we'll probably do that a little later in the show, why don't you just kind of quickly tell us a little something about Gunlach Bunshu, how it got started, how you ended up evolving over what's a century and a half now?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a quite a story with all sorts of high and low points throughout it. As you mentioned, it was Jacob Gunlach that founded the winery, and he did so after traveling from Germany and arriving through the Golden Gate a year to the day after he left with a couple barrels of brandy and all his worldly possessions.
And he was a beer man, right?
That's what happened. He basically immediately got in with a brewer and ended up owning the brewery, and a few years later was able to buy the property where the winery now sits, just outside the town of Sonoma. And really, it was, I guess, a period of unbridled growth through the 1870s and 80s. It was in the 70s when Charles Bunshu came into the picture, first as a you know, employee, and then as a son-in-law and partner. And when Jacob died,
so he married up.
He sure did. You know, all the male Bunshus took note in that for uh-huh. sure. But we, you know, basically the way it worked, the grapes were always grown here in Sonoma, but through the end of that century, everything was shipped by barge. The must was shipped by barge and then aged in redwood tanks in a big warehouse winery down in San Francisco. So by the time that Jacob died in the mid 1890s, the winery was very large, even relatively so by today's standards, 250,000 cases.
Mm-hmm.
Really it was a success story, and Charles was on the track to continuing that until the earthquake struck, the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906. And that really was the first thing in our family history that changed the direction, among a few things that have happened since then. But essentially, the winery withstood the earthquake, but the fires really put it to its end. In
yeah.
fact, there were four big wine warehouses in a row down there, and the firefighters, not having any water because the water mains had broken, used the wine out of cask to try mm-hmm. to put the fire out. So we essentially, Charles was devastated, and his sons were as anxious to carry on as you might expect, but they didn't have a whole lot to carry on, and so the winery kind of what I called stumbled along until Prohibition really put a nail in the coffin of the wine producing portion of it for some time. The vineyards were always producing up here in Sonoma, and the earthquake basically forced the family that had been living for the most part in San Francisco to relocate full time up here. And really, when the winery shut its door at Prohibition, it was a Sonoma focused operation.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those early years and explain to our listeners why the focal point was San Francisco. Because wine country back then wasn't like wine country is today. It wasn't a magnet for tourists. It was, you had to get wine to the market, and the market was San Francisco and all the workers there, right?
That's exactly right. And the wineries, there was. There were four major wineries down there, along with at first it was Jay Gundlach and Company, and then it became Gundlach Bunchu Company, and this was on what's now Bryant Street in downtown San Francisco. And of those four, the only one that may ring a bell to any modern day wine drinkers would be Inglenook. The other two are names that are long since forgotten, and really the grapes were sourced in, for the most part, all over Northern California. You know, at that time there were grapes in the peninsula, you know, all down what's now Silicon Valley. There were grapes to the east in
Livermore Valley.
And the wines were also not necessarily all still wines. The wines that stayed locally in the area were still, but because San Francisco was such an export oriented city at the time, by that I mean export to other parts of the country
and
other parts of the world.
And the railroad was there, sure.
A lot of the wines that were produced were fortified, so like high alcohol brandy, things that would travel well and withstand certain amount of oxidation.
Now, in 1870, somebody didn't go to the wine shop and get a bottle of wine off the shelf. How did the wineries deliver the wine to the customer?
Well, a lot of the way it worked, at least in San Francisco around our neighborhood, was there were, I don't know what you'd call them today. I have a feeling bodegas maybe originate, that word originates from them, but you would walk in and there wouldn't be bottles on the shelf, but there'd be barrels.
Yeah.
And you'd bring your own container and fill the barrels.
Your jug.
And you know, you'd basically bring that jug home and refill it. And at the time, San Francisco was truly a metropolitan city. In fact, when Jacob first arrived, he didn't have his love with him. He went back a few years later and picked up Ava, who ended up being his wife. And Ava writes home to her mother that San Francisco's so wonderful she doesn't even have to learn English because everybody speaks German and French.
A truly international city.
Right.
Yeah. Now, was that because of the gold rush and it just drew people from all over the world, or was it because of building the railroad? I mean, what was the impetus? And, you know, obviously, it has a big port, so you had ships coming in from all over the world.
I think the gold rush really was what, in a few short decades, transformed the city. And it was not necessarily just the gold rush. It was also the silver mining and along the Sierra Nevada that was done in Nevada, along with the railroad. All those sort of natural resource companies that made the West what it was used San Francisco as its main outlet to either export or to distribute. And that's not even withstanding the number of immigrants that came by ship from Asia and from Europe. As I said, my great-great-great-grandfather was one of many that came around to San Francisco without even knowing of Ellis Island or going anywhere near the east coast of the U.S. He was shipwrecked off the coast of Africa and then went down around South America. And he writes in his journal that he knows where pods of other Europeans are as he goes on that journey, or at least other Germans, but he comments that he wants to get up here where they can grow wine.
You know, you would think at that part in our country's history, almost everyone was European.
Huge
percentage.
In our case, with some Asians, but that's for certain.
Yeah. Lou, I'm looking at my engineer. Lou, do we have more time in this segment, or are we going to have to take a little break here? Lou's not saying anything to me. He's okay. So we're gonna just keep talking, Jeff. I have a question I want to ask you, and I didn't want to ask you going into the break and lose you. No, there's the music coming. When we come back on the other side of the break, I want to talk about your written history of what the wine was like back then, what kind of grapes you used in those pre-20th century wines. So Whitley on Wine will continue with Jeff Bunshu of Gundlach Bunshu Winery in Sonoma County following these messages.
Talk to me nice. Peel me a grape.
And now, back to Whitley on Wine.
Slowly.
With your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
I'm back, and I'm chatting with Jeff Bunshu, the president, CEO of Gundlach Bunshu Winery, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. And Jeff, just by way of explanation, I should explain. You know, I'm sitting here in the studio, and I'm looking out at Lou, our engineer, and he's in the control room, and all these people are hovering over his computer, and I'm thinking, and we're right about at break time, and I'm thinking, should I ask another question? Or, Houston, do we have a problem? And but finally we figured it out. Anyway, I asked a question, threw it to you before we went in the break. What were the wines like back then? What do you know from your written record of the style of wines, what they tasted like? Were there any tasting notes as we know tasting notes today? And what were the grape varieties used?
Well, you know, the closest thing we have to the written record is a vineyard map, essentially, that maps out the varietals that were on the property at the time. And then we've got labels, and then generally all the marketing materials are sort of winery and specific, and not necessarily wine specific, if that makes any sense. All, you know, with all the marketing materials implying that everything from the winery was good. What was planted, though, the one varietal that makes sense today, or there's a few, but the one that we still make is Cabernet. But there was also Sylvaner. There was something called a Goutadel, which you may know more about than I do.
I'm not familiar with that. So, but were they all blended red and blended white? We didn't really have varietal distinction.
That's exactly right.
I don't think
right.
until much later.
They were blended, you know, and I think that even we have some old Cabernet labels, but we have every reason to believe that even those were blended at the time
with
all sorts of red wines. We did have a chance to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the earthquake, where we made a big deal and kind of hiked around the city where the family had its business and playtime. This was a couple years ago, and that night we opened a bottle of pre-prohibition wine, and that was pretty special. It actually held up a little bit. It had some acid in it, and it tasted.
You could taste some flavors.
You could taste a little bit. I mean,
maybe
definitely
some fruit
had
left.
It tasted like a good red California Bordeaux that had been sitting around for.
Well, you know, once or twice in my life, I've had some of those old Beaulieu Vineyard wines that Andre Telichev made that were called Burgundy.
Yep, right.
They weren't Burgundy.
No, not at all.
You know, I think back then, everything, if it was red, it was Burgundy, and if it was white, it was Chablis.
That's right. That's
right. You know,
right.
Or it was whatever name that you could come up with that sounded cool and you could sell. But, you know, people drank wine then. They were Europeans. They were used to having wine with their meals. Workers were used to having wine at lunchtime.
Yeah, that was the wine was really part of the culture here. Yeah.
Now, I didn't know until I read the notes on your anniversary that your famous vineyard is the Rhine Farm Vineyard, and I didn't realize that came from the old Gundlach, the original owner of the winery, and. I'm wondering, how big was Gundlach Bunshu? You know, you mentioned that you had vineyards, but you sourced vineyards from all over. How big was the vineyard, the estate property, way back when?
It was about, all told, it was about 600 contiguous acres. And within that, there were a number of different owners, some of which were 100%. Some of the vineyards were 100% owned by Gunlock or Gunlock, and then there were partnerships all around it. So it actually at that time looked a lot more like a Burgundian map, where there's different owners of different rows. I mean, it wasn't quite down to that level, but there was a number of different sections. That's morphed over the years.
Was that done for economic reasons to spread the risk?
It was just consolidation of people that wanted to be involved and who had money to put into vineyards and Gunlock had a winery that could use them.
Was it a little bit like a co-op?
I would say that it probably operated quite a bit like a co-op, given that there just weren't that many wineries to sell the grapes to in those days.
Yeah. Now, do you have any photographs from that period?
We do. We have a great picture of our tasting room. Well, we now call it our winery. Front of our winery was built circa 1870, and we have a picture of it back about that time. We have a picture that we have a number of photographs, but one that stands out as a good reminder to make sure we take every day at a time and have a good time is what was left of the warehouse after the fire. And it's an astounding picture because essentially the building, which was some sort of masonry, is pretty much destroyed. And it's looking across the interior, and you see what looks like a bunch of spaghetti until you look closely and realize that those were all the tank rungs, the redwood tank rungs that the wood burned out, but the spaghetti,
the metal was still there. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So when you moved up to Sonoma County, you already had a base of operations there because you've had vineyards and whatnot. What's the history of the facility there? I mean, I've been up to the winery, but I don't know how far back that dates. And, you know, it's a nice location. You're up on a hill. You're overlooking the Carneros region, and you've been there a long time.
Yeah, really, it is the modern history of the winery is all here based around this property. The winery, there were actually two wineries on the property over the course of the years. One was where the winery is now, and there was another one which is now an equipment shop for our farming operation. But essentially, the whole focus changed by necessity and then also by will through that period. After Prohibition made it such that my great-grandfathers had to close the winery.
Well, I was going to say, I don't want to interrupt
what you're saying,
but how did you survive Prohibition?
Well, it was all there were two brothers at the time, Charles Bunchu and Francisca Gunlock, had two sons that were in the business, and one of the sons who didn't stay on the property, so he'd be my great-uncle, his name was Carl, he was the winemaker and went over the hill to Napa and became the first winemaker that Gustav Niebaum's widow hired before John Daniels. His name was Carl Bunchu, and really, so when Prohibition was receded, my great grandfather Walter, Carl's brother, was already ensconced as a farmer, and he had a ready market to his brother to sell grapes to.
Yeah.
So essentially, it went from a wine making operation to a grape growing operation.
And when did you return to making wine?
Well, that's all about my dad and my grandfather. It was a partnership between the two of them in the late 60s, early 70s, where my father had grown up on the ranch and developed a love of farming and a love of grape growing.
And your father being Jim.
My father being Jim, exactly. Mm-hmm. And he had a different vision for the winery and convinced my grandfather that it was viable, and that was to reopen the winery under the historic name, but really focus the production on what the property itself could do, and really on the he had in his mind the sort of the Bordelaise model of a single winery surrounded by all the vineyards that produces its wine right there on site.
So more of an estate.
Exactly. Estate, and that's really the legacy
sort of
that I'm trying to carry on today. It's all about the fact that we control, all our vineyards are around us, and we control all aspects of farming them and growing the grapes and then making the wine.
And that is a great area for grapes. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Sonoma Valley where you're located?
Well, it is a great area, and one of the things that probably makes it most exciting is its diversity. Sonoma County itself is very large and has a number of appellations in it. Sonoma Valley is the appellation that's the farthest south and the farthest east without being in Carneros. And we ourselves are in the farthest southeast corner of Sonoma Valley. We are at the base of the Mayacamas range, the southern tip of them, mm-hmm. and between that our position on that mountain range and also as far south as we are, we have a great diversity of essentially cool climate growing conditions on our property. And it's a diversity that allows us to grow high-acid, bright fruit varietals like Chardonnay and Pinot Noir on the valley floor, but also get very interesting cooler climate Bordeaux varietals on our hillside vineyard.
And Cabernet and Merlot, and you probably have some Cabernet Franc as
well. We do. We actually have a little of all five, Cabernet and Merlot being the Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot being the main two, but we do a great job with Cabernet Franc too. Most of it gets blended.
And you're also relatively famous for your Zinfandel.
Yeah, you know, our Zinfandel is something that we make a very small amount, but it is so distinctive that it's put us on the map for many years for those who liked it and found the white pepper that we get out of it pretty attractive. It's a it's a cool climate Zinfandel, meaning that we'd be hard pressed to find any Zinfandel planted quite as cool as where this is, and as a result, the alcohol levels are always relatively moderate. And you get a lot more white pepper than you do big jammy fruit.
I think a similar white pepper characteristic used to be found in the old Haywood Zinfandels.
That would make a lot of sense. Relatively similar growing regions.
Very close to the same area.
Yep.
And whatnot. When did you move into those grape varieties, though? Because I remember, Rodney Strong telling the story and the guys at Schramsberg telling the story that there was a time in the 60s when they couldn't even find Chardonnay.
Yeah, it was right after, that period that when my dad decided to replant the vineyard, and our original cuttings came from essentially two families who had a lot to do with importing clones at that time, the Martinis and the Wentes. And the Cabernet, there was already a pretty decent stash around in Napa. But for the cool climate varietals, those families managed to have they did a lot of work in the early days of bringing over clones that we then got not directly from them, but got from cuttings from vineyards that they had sold budwood to.
Yeah.
In our case, our Chardonnay, we went over to a famous Napa Valley ranch called the Seas Ranch, which is now owned by Silverado, and sourced this Wente clone that it turns out, 35 years later is one of the more desired clones out there. So we're replanting it.
Jeff, we're going to have to take a break. That's our sign when the music comes up. But when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the plans that you have to celebrate the 150th and this play that you've commissioned. I find that very fascinating. Anyway, we will continue with Jeff Bunshu of Gunlock Bunshu Winery following these messages.